The return of Jamie and John, our favorite automotive experts. The North American International Automotive Show is underway in Detroit, and that means car and truck lovers are buzzing with excitement about concept cars and other new models from the manufacturers. Lots of the press so far has focused on the new pickup trucks out there. They are lighter, stronger, more fuel efficient, and just fancier than last year's models. People are also checking out the prototype driverless cars, some without steering wheels. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Main Calling, we will talk about the big changes underway in the automotive world with Jamie Page Deaton of U.S. News and World Report and John Paul of AAA. This is also your chance to ask them questions about car buying, driving in winter, snow tires, and more. Main Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Which is better for winter driving, a front-wheel drive car with snow tires or an all-wheel drive car with all-season tires? What's the best way to warm up a car on a cold winter day? Start the engine and let it run for a while? Just get in and drive? Or is there a third option? Well, today, our car experts are with us to answer these questions and also talk about trends that they're seeing from the big automotive show in Detroit. Joining me from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, Jamie Page Deaton. She is automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report. On the line with us from his office, John Paul. He's spokesperson for AAA of New England and a master mechanic. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about winter driving or car shopping or anything else automotive? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jamie, I guess it's not called the Detroit Auto Show, but really the North American International Automotive Show in Detroit. But in any case, seems like all the headlines are about pickup trucks.
Exactly. Almost every major American brand showed a pickup truck there. You had the new Silverado from Chevy. You had a diesel F-150 plus Ford announcing that they are bringing back the Ford Ranger. And then you had a brand new Ram 1500 being shown. So all around, it was very much a truck show, which is a little bit strange for Detroit. Usually you see a lot of trucks being shown at the Chicago Auto Show. But this year, the automakers decided that Detroit was the place for all their super big truck debuts.
And I think it was in U.S. News and World Report that the top three selling cars in North America are trucks, pickup trucks.
Exactly. Yeah. The market right now basically is as consumers are leaving cars and gas prices stay low. And you have to see, you know, the fuel economy on trucks is just getting very, very good. It's almost like consumers can kind of have their cake and eat it, too. Like you can get all of the capability of a full size truck with, you know, a V6 engine and fuel economy that was unthinkable even a couple of years ago. So there's really not a lot of downside for consumers now to go buy a new large truck because people absolutely love them. In some cases, they love them because they need them for work. In other cases, they want it to look like they're doing work or they have an active lifestyle and it's more of a lifestyle vehicle. But for automakers, this is absolutely great news because the profit margins are a lot higher on trucks than they are on affordable small cars. So this is, you know, a trend that's been building for a while and it shows really no sign of stopping in the near future.
John Paul, as you notice what's coming out of Detroit and the auto show, what is piquing your interest?
Well, I really think the truck thing is really interesting. It you know, you look at that and you said, you know, that's amazing that they look at trucks and they look at trucks because of one reason. I think it's high profits. You know, it wasn't that many years ago. It seemed like 40 was the new 30, and that was miles per gallon. And we're looking at all these cars that got close to 40 miles per gallon or even better. But today we're seeing that shift. And although trucks are still getting better fuel economy, trucks are what people want. Trucks and SUVs and big SUVs, and you look at them going down the road, and I think Jamie's actually right. They're for people who work with their trucks and for people who want to look like they work with their trucks, because I see an awful lot of people that don't look like they probably would know what end of a hammer to hold.
John, what is good mileage for a truck these days?
Well, if you can get above 20 miles per gallon on a truck, I think you're doing pretty good. The difference between a gasoline truck and a diesel truck is a gasoline truck, when it's loaded, if it's pulling a trailer, if you're somebody that uses a big utility trailer, maybe you carry, landscaping equipment, or maybe you're just moving from one place to another, you're going to see the fuel economy when you're towing that trailer drop down from maybe 18, 19, 20 miles per gallon. It's going to drop down to 12, 13, or 14. The difference is, and Ford is doing this with the diesel, and the same thing with Ram with its diesel. Diesel fuel economy doesn't change that much because they have these huge torque numbers, and torque is what gets a vehicle moving, and that's where a gasoline engine suffers a bit. When you need to really push on the gas pedal to get moving with a gasoline engine, diesel has that almost instantaneous torque. And that's what the fuel economy savings is. So I think as we're starting to see more of these sort of light duty diesels in these half ton pickup trucks, we're going to even see more and more of those. Even though, at least where I live, diesel fuel is really above premium fuel prices right now.
Jamie, another thing, John mentioned Ford, and I want to say that I'm reading an article right now that says Ford Motor Company is going to have fewer models in the future and almost no sedans. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Ford is, trimming its lineup. They're investing more in kind of the profit drivers like your trucks and your SUVs. And they're also investing a lot of money into electrified and autonomous vehicles. So for the time being, Ford is kind of playing the entire table except the middle, which is the sedan market. And that makes, again, you look at the market right now, it makes absolute and total sense. People are not buying cars. They are not buying kind of, I mean, they're buying cars, but they aren't buying cars, which is your typical family sedan. The family sedan has gone from being, just a car to being a small SUV, sort of a tall station wagon, with all-wheel drive. And if you look at kind of the sales numbers across the board for every automaker, they are really, really terrible when it comes to just cars. And it's the automakers that have a diversified lineup that has a good line of SUVs in addition to their cars, or to be honest, frankly, that focus on SUVs entirely and don't have cars at all in their dealerships. Those are the ones that are doing really well now because they're meeting consumer preferences. And the other side of it, too, is consumers are willing to pay more for SUVs than they are for cars because there's a perception there that you're getting more. And to a degree, that's true. You're getting more space, you're getting a higher seating position. But that also means for automakers, these are higher profit vehicles where they're able to put, they're able to spend the same amount of money to develop it, but you're willing to pay more for it. So that extra goes into their pocket. And so, Ford's stock, and it was down a little bit on the announcement that they were, investing more in autonomous and electrified cars and things like that, moving away from sedans. But ultimately, like, this is a smart long-term move because it's putting, it's putting their resources where the highest profits are going to be.
Well, it's interesting too, because as they're focusing on pickup trucks and SUVs, they're also focusing putting billions of dollars into electric vehicles. So even though the consumer isn't there now, they seem pretty darn certain the consumer will be there in the future.
Exactly. They're playing, with the trucks and SUVs right now, they're playing the short-term game. With electrified vehicles, they're playing the long-term game as well. Now, if you remember back in 2008, where we had, the beginning of the Great Recession, and automotive sales were really terrible, partially because gas prices went up and automakers had nothing else to offer consumers except gas-guzzling heavy trucks and SUVs. Now, what automakers are doing is they've learned from that. They want to develop a lineup that, suits the person who wants a big truck or an SUV, but also have very good, very efficient models in their back pocket for when consumer tastes change. And then when you see that too, they're also serving, two different types of buyers. The person who either needs a big heavy truck or SUV for work or just wants to look like they do, as well as kind of the early adopter technophile that really wants an electrified vehicle, and they're going to go for a share of that market as well.
I'm going to read to you a quote from a Bloomberg article. "The auto industry is undergoing the most upheaval since the advent of Henry Ford's assembly line. The changes were as evident as the meteor and sonic boom that rattled the frigid city of Detroit this week." Jamie, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. This is, you know, I've been covering the industry for 10 years, and this has been, you know, the most exciting, you know, 2 years or so as really autonomous and electrified vehicles have really started to take off and really have begun to move forward much more rapidly than I think anybody anticipated. I mean, Chevy announced at the auto show that they would begin selling a car with no steering wheel and no pedals, you know, starting in 2019. And so granted, that car, and it's the Cruise AV, it'll be in, you know, a geofenced area. It's not a true driverless car. It's going to be in certain areas where the roads are really well mapped. But just the fact that you'd be able to, you know, hail a ride from a car with no driver, I mean, that's just mind-blowing. And it's totally going to change, you know, how we interact with cars. Now, that doesn't mean that tomorrow we'll all be getting, or even next year or the year after, that, you know, we'll all be going up and down 95 in driverless cars. But we're farther along than I think most people anticipated even just a few years ago. And, you know, within the next 20 years, we're going to see just a seismic shift in the industry. And it's exciting to see, and it's great to be along for the ride.
So let's talk a little bit more about this car, the Chevy. 2019, next year, if I wanted to and could afford it, could buy a car without a steering wheel and a gas pedal. How would that work? I wouldn't keep it in my garage, would I?
Oh, no. Actually, and what they're using it for is for fleet service. So you, Jennifer, would not be able to buy it unless you wanted to get a fleet of cars for ride sharing and ride hailing. So really what they're looking at it is very well mapped downtown areas. So like downtown LA, downtown Boston, you know, downtown New York, where the roads are, where the car has learned the roads very, very well. Because honestly, if you take a car without a steering wheel or without pedals out into the backwoods of Maine, that car is going to have a lot of problems. But if you're looking at a downtown area where all the, where it's, everything is mapped out. And the other thing too, is these cars will be geofenced. So they're not going to be able to leave the area. But what they're thinking is if you're in downtown Boston, or I don't know, maybe even downtown Portland, if they bring it there, you would be able to, you know, use an app on your phone and basically hail a driverless Lyft or a driverless Uber. The car would roll up, you'd get in it for short trips within the downtown area where the car is allowed to go. You'd be able to take it there with no one monitoring it, no one driving it. Now, the big question of this is, will consumers accept it? You know, I think there's a lot of hesitation around, and there's been plenty of studies that show that the biggest hurdle that comes with autonomous vehicles is getting people to accept it. And I think anybody who's tried to use, you know, a wireless printer, the thought of getting into a car without a driver is pretty frightening. But, you know, they're here, they're coming, and it'll be really interesting to see what happens when Chevy starts rolling these out and people start using them.
Boy, I'll have to say, I think I'd rather be in a driverless car in the back roads of Maine than downtown Boston. That's a scary place to be in any kind of vehicle. Holy cow. Hey, John Paul, welcome back. I know that we had a little bit of technical problem, and hopefully you'll sound loud and clear now. I want to get some winter driving tips. And the first one I'm going to ask about is, even though I've lived in Maine for a long time, I'm noticing that this year, my car, something about the weather this year, every time I stop my car and get out, I've got packed snow and ice in my wheel wells. I don't know if there's something special about the storms we've had recently. How bad is that for your car and your driving, and how often do you need to clean that out?
Well, it's always a good idea to clean it out, because that snow also contains a lot of salt, and the salt is corrosive to your car. So it's a good idea to get under there and clean it out every once in a while. Also, if it builds up enough in the suspension, you're going to get all kinds of weird noises. But more of what we hear people having problems with is they leave the car overnight, it snows, it's parked outside, and they're on their way to work or to go do an errand, and the car's shaking like crazy. And they're like, what's wrong with the car? Did it break? Is there a bad tire? No, it's actually all that snow built up in the wheels, and then it's thrown the tires out of balance, and you would be absolutely convinced that the wheels were ready to fall off the car. So we hear an awful lot about that, and people are really concerned about, is there something really wrong with the car? When in fact, there's really nothing wrong with it other than there's a lot of snow and ice built up. So it's always a good idea, especially as we treat the roads, and we treat the roads with some fairly corrosive things these days. You know, it used to be just salt. Now it's calcium and sodium chloride mixes together. Sometimes it's a brine solution, the same kind of stuff you make pickles in. They coat the road with that. It's great for road safety. It's not so great for cars, though.
And let me ask you something else. We've had some really, really cold weather, you know, sub-zero, couple weeks in a row. Hopefully that won't happen again this season. But how do we think about our cars differently when we're talking about that really cold weather? How is -5 different than 15 degrees for our car?
Well, in these kind of really cold temperatures where the temperatures drop below zero, we really need to think about how we warm up our cars and how we drive our cars, at least for the first few minutes of driving. Because some people, you know, maybe they'll have a remote starter, maybe they'll just run out and go start the car and then run in the house and take a shower and come back. And what they've done is they've warmed up the engine, but they haven't really warmed up the rest of the car. Power steering fluid can still be cold. Differential fluid can be cold. The metal components, even things like axle shafts and the lubricant for those parts, is still as cold as it was before you went to warm the car up. So it's so important when the weather is cold like this to start up the car, let it run for a few minutes. It doesn't have to be that long, but drive the car nice and easy until you start to get some heat out of the heating system. When you start to get some heat out of the heating system, that means the temperatures have started to come up to a point where you can drive the car normally. In fact, some cars today will actually have a blue light that comes on, and that when you first start the car when it's cold, and that blue light means take it easy, I'm cold, don't push the accelerator real hard, and allow the car to warm up. When you talk to people who drive cars routinely 200,000 and 300,000 miles, that's how they get the longevity out of the car, by treating the car nice and easy when it's really cold. It's those it's people that get in the car, start it up, and just put it in gear and drive away with their foot to the floor. Those are the ones that wear out engines and transmissions in this cold weather.
Okay, well, we have to go to break pretty soon, but first I have to ask you about something else I read about the Detroit Auto Show, that Subaru has a new SUV, a fancy one called the Ascent, with 19 cup holders. Jamie, you understand the psychology of the automotive industry. Why do we need 19 cup holders in a car that may seat 5 people at the most?
The Ascent seats 7.
Oh, okay.
The ratio's a little
off.
So
it's still more than 2 per person.
Yeah, we're very thirsty. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I use cup holders very rarely for cups now. I mean, this is where you're putting, you know, smartphones in the back. And one thing that I've noticed in three-row SUVs that you see a lot of now is, you know, the back seats are now becoming kind of technology hubs. So you maybe have one cup back there for an actual drink, and then you have another cup holder for somebody, you know, your kid's phone, and there's a USB port back there for charging, or a power port for charging. And so it's really more about just stowing everything away. And, you know, cup holders aren't always for cups. I will say, though, Subaru introduced that at the LA Auto Show, and they did a great introduction where they had a family of golden retrievers driving the car onto the stage. And then Tom Dahl, the president of Subaru, had to give a presentation while a bunch of golden retriever puppies were running around the stage. And it was hilarious. And if you have a chance to go, you know, look for it on YouTube or something, I highly recommend it because it was a great vehicle introduction.
Okay, we'll try to find that and put it on our Main Calling Facebook page. John Paul, before I go to a break, I have to ask you, what do you think of a car with 19 cup holders?
I think it's just people are slobs and they don't take their empty cups out with them and they need a place to put another one. I think Jamie's right. I think a lot of times when I get in the car, my sunglasses go in a cup holder, my phone goes in a cup holder, and you know, maybe one cup holder gets used. But on the other hand, there are people that drive with, they have to have a water bottle, a coffee cup, and something else. So maybe all these cup holders get used. But the idea of having 2.3 cup holders per person sounds a bit much to me.
And is this an American thing, or do Europeans and people in Asia like their cup holders too?
I think it's an American thing.
Oh, a friend of mine was just in, yeah, it really is. A friend of mine was just in Germany, and he rented a new BMW, and he couldn't find a place to put his water bottle because they don't have cup holders.
Oh, no. Okay, well, we're late to a break. We're going to take listener calls and questions when we come back. This is Main Calling. Stay with us.
You make Main Calling possible, as do the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public. And Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
Christian Picciolini was a teenager looking for identity and purpose when he joined a violent white supremacist group, believing he was protecting the white race from extinction. He eventually got out and now works to combat hate and racism. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear about his transformation and his new memoir, White American Youth. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio. This June, Maine Public Travel is visiting Iceland, an island nation known for its summer's midnight sun, black sand beaches, and unique culture. You can join us on the trip from June 17th through the 23rd. We'll explore the country, visiting natural wonders like geothermal pools and waterfalls. Plus, our own Jennifer Rooks will host a talk show at ROOF, that's Iceland's public broadcasting organization. For more information, visit mainepublic.org and click Education, or call 1-877-479-7040. Again, that's 1-877-479-7040. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the latest from the world of cars, trucks, and SUVs. On the line with us, Jamie Page Deaton, automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul, spokesperson for AAA of New England and a master mechanic. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Jonathan Smith, our producer, reminded me I have been remiss. Usually I start the program by asking each of you what you've been driving and whether you like it, what you've been able to drive because you are automotive journalists. So, John Paul, what have you been driving recently and what are you excited about?
Well, I can't say it's a great winter car, but I just recently drove the new Volkswagen Golf GTI. And you know, that was a car that really, when the term hot hatchback came out, that was a car that really set the tone for that. And it is just a delightful car to drive. The one I drove was a manual transmission, so it actually had a real clutch like standard transmissions were meant to be. And it was probably one of the easiest standard transmission cars to drive because it has this perfect horsepower torque curve that just makes it really easy to drive. If you're not a standard shift driver on a regular basis, this is a car that you're not going to stall. It's going to be easy to drive. It's fun to drive. The seats were comfortable. The handling was great. Is it a good car to drive when, you know, down around my way we got 18 inches of snow? Not really a good car for that. But on the other hand, it was a car that was just, it was very enjoyable, and it's a hatchback, so you could put the rear seats down. It had plenty of room in the back of it. It was just a delightful car to drive, and it's one that if people are looking for just the sort of fun, somewhat economical, now they don't give GTIs away. I think the as-delivered price on this car was close to $31,000, but if you want a sporty car that's also a little bit stealthy, it has a nice exhaust tone to it, a little on the subtle side, so it's not loud and obnoxious. And what I liked about it, I didn't feel like an old guy in a young car. I felt like this is a car I could drive all day long, and you know, different than something like a Subaru WRX, especially the STI version, where I like driving that car a lot because it's a little hot rod, but on the other hand, I always feel like I'm too old when I'm behind the wheel.
And what about you, Jamie Page Deaton?
I had recently the Lincoln Navigator, which was absolutely exquisite. It's one of the favorite cars that I've ever driven.
Wow,
for me,
that's saying a lot.
I know. And for me, kind of like I had a lot riding on this because emotionally, as you know, a kid growing up in the 90s and watching like Total Request Live and all the rap videos would have, you know, these rappers driving Lincoln Navigators. So this is a new generation of it. And I was really worried that they were going to screw it up. And they didn't. It was absolutely wonderful. The interior design was very modern. And open an area and very kind of mid-century modern where you could see like Don Draper would drive this car. And it was just a gorgeous car inside and out. It did great in the snow, very comfortable, smart interior. Now, to be fair, this was the black label, which is the upmarket, the highest trim that you could get. And so it's stickered for $100,000, which I thought was a little ridiculous. But the more I drove it, the more I was like, oh, yeah, I could swing this totally. I need this. I deserve this. And then this week I'm driving the BMW X3, which is surprisingly a disappointment. It just doesn't have the feel that you associate with BMWs. It feels very kind of tinny and it's insubstantial. And the other thing with it, too, is it costs, you know, the sticker on the one I'm driving is about $57,000. And I have no idea where they spent the money. I can't really, you know, if it was between, you know, the BMW X3 and the Mazda CX-5, I'd be CX-5 all the way. I mean, it's done okay in the snow and the slush and things. But overall, it's just a disappointment, especially for the price and for the BMW.
So especially coming right after that Lincoln Navigator, right?
Yeah. Well, between the Navigator and the X3, I had the Ford Expedition, which is basically the same as the Navigator, but a little bit more affordable. I mean, and by more affordable, the one was like $70,000. But for a three-row SUV, I actually had it while my in-laws were in town and was able to get everybody in it because the third row was incredibly comfortable. The second row was captain's chairs, plenty of room, you know, even for people who are, you know, maybe a little bit thin. And there was just lots of space, and it was very smart in terms of how the interior was put together. And it wasn't all that big to drive. You know, I could whip it in and out of, you know, the parking lot at school or daycare or the grocery store, which is often a downside when you're looking at a big three-row truck-based SUV. So it was all around. You know, the Lincoln and the Ford were great. The BMW, not so much.
All right. Well, we have so many people who want to ask questions. We're going to start with Susan, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. So over the last 30-plus years, I've had four Honda Accords. Two have saved my life in head-on collisions, not my fault. Mm. And so I'm looking for what might be my last car. And I've been waiting for the Accord to come out with an all-wheel drive. Never happened. And so my husband took me out looking for cars because he said he'll buy me whatever I want. And I tried the Alfa Romeo Stelvio. Loved the way it looked on the outside. Didn't like the drive. The Lexus SUVs all look the same to me. Every SUV looks the same, and I wanted something that kind of stood out. If they made that Accord in an all-wheel drive, that would be it. So I'm wondering, what can I get for an all-wheel drive? It doesn't have to be a big SUV. I do want a nice car that's going to last me, that I can have at least five people seated in it, and that I can pull down, you know, like have the whatever the hatch area, you know, I can put my skis in. Because I'm noticing that some of the concept cars now only, the SUVs only seat four people, which I thought was absolutely crazy. So I'm looking for answers for that. And if I should be looking at electric cars or crossovers.
All right, Jamie, I'm going to throw this one to you.
Yeah, actually, Susan, you've got a lot of good options there. And, you know, I commend you on your 400 Accords. I've got to say the new one is absolutely wonderful. It just won North American Car of the Year. It doesn't come with all-wheel drive, though, unfortunately, as you noted. And I think you were smart to pass on the Stelvio. But I would say you have a couple of options within the larger Honda family. The Acura RDX is their small SUV. It's available with all-wheel drive. They just unveiled a new 2019 model at the Detroit Auto Show, but you can go and, you know, get a 2018 and do really well with it. It's a very smart, comfortable, practical SUV that is upmarket because Acura is Honda's luxury brand. And if you don't want to spend quite that much, also take a look at the Honda CR-V. If you go for the top trims of the CR-V, you're going to end up with a car that's very nearly as nice as the upper trims of the Accord, but you're going to have the SUV space and you're going to have all-wheel drive available to you. And I've been in, you know, the back seats of both of these cars. It's plenty roomy for five people. You really don't have to worry about that. And the other one that I would encourage you to look at would be either the Ford Edge, which, again, if you go for the upper trims of the Edge, it's a very distinctive-looking SUV with very luxurious interior, which you might not expect from Ford, but you're actually ending up, you know, when you look at the upmarket trims, it's actually quite nice to look at. The other thing that you might want to look at is the Volvo XC60. That was recently redesigned for this year, and it you have a lot of options there depending on how much you want to spend. You can start at around $40,000 and get a very good, very competent SUV that's comfortable, has great technology, excellent safety, particularly the active safety features. And if you want to spend more, you can get a plug-in hybrid version. So if you're thinking about an electric car, this is one where you can keep it plugged in at home. And if you drive around 30 miles or so a day, you're going to be all on electric power, but there's a backup engine there. So if you go beyond 30 miles, you don't have to worry about stopping to charge. The gas engine just kicks in and you can go on your way.
All right, Susan, it sounds like you're going to have to do some test driving. Thanks for your call. We're going to go to Joel in Litchfield. Hi, Joel. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I've got a Subaru Outback and have Michelin Defenders, and they have been good in the snow, not so much on just wet surfaces. I'm thinking of the Michelin AS Premier tire, although some dealers said Michelins are too soft for the New England weather? Or is there a better match for the Subaru?
All right, John Paul, do you have thoughts?
Well, the Michelin tires are not super high mileage tires, but they are such good tires. They are they generally wear well. They wear well throughout the life of the tire, where some other tires might claim to have 60 and 80,000 mile life, but you know, once they get 30,000 miles on them, they start to scallop and cup a little bit. They require a lot more constant rotation, where the Michelins don't seem to do that. The other thing is the Michelin rubber compounds. You're actually looking for a softer rubber compound in the cold temperatures, because we kind of did away with the term snow tires years ago, and we talk more about winter tires. In winter tires, the compound that the tires are made out of works better in cold temperatures. So on a perfectly dry day that's 5 above zero, a tire that you look at might look like it's going to work well, but because the tire rubber compound is hard, it tends to not to be sticky. So you get, first off, you might get noise, but more importantly, you get a tire that doesn't grip. So for winter tires, I look for a tire that is going to be good in cold temperatures. That's important to me, as well as one that is designed to actually dig through the snow. So it's the combination. Again, Michelin is one of those tires. When people talk about comparing tires from one to another, a lot of them use Michelin is, that's the goal that they want to set to try to match. So I don't think you'd go wrong with that. Particular version of Michelin tires. But what I would do, I would look at some of the big tire websites like Tire Rack and look at consumer reviews and look up that particular tire, see who matched it up with a Subaru, and see where they live and see what they think of the overall performance of that tire and see how it works out. But in general, Michelin tires, when people want to solve problems with their cars because of vibrations or noises or something else, Michelin's always the go-to tire for that. Again, a good high-quality tire. The other thing, there are some other good winter tires out there. Certainly, Nokia makes some. There's a bunch of them out there you can look at. But again, winter tires, not really snow tires, winter tires, because of that soft rubber compound that maybe doesn't last as long, but it's stickier, and that's what gets you where you want to go.
I'm going to ask you a follow-up question, John. Yeah, we've been talking throughout this program about how popular all-wheel drive SUVs are. If I have an all-wheel drive SUV, is it important to change out the tires and get winter tires?
Depending what tires are on there to start off with, sort of an old rule of thumb, and it hasn't changed a whole heck of a lot. If you have good all-season tires, they are going to perform about 70% as well as a snow tire or winter tire in about maybe 4 to 6 inches of snow. If the snow gets heavier or the temperatures get lower, that's where it's very important to have a winter tire on your car. I have, we have two cars in our household, an old SUV and a Volkswagen Beetle convertible. It's a couple of years old. A couple of years ago, I was driving an Audi A6 all-wheel drive. It didn't have winter tires on it. I drove it to the end of my street. I turned it around. I came back and took my wife's Volkswagen, which had a good all-season tire on it. And why I brought it back was the tires that were on that Audi, not that it didn't get going okay, it didn't stop well. It stopped horribly. And because of that, I was concerned that in the cold temperatures with a little bit of snow on the road, it just was going to be an unsafe drive. So I took the Volkswagen instead. So, yeah, it is important, depending on what kind of tires are on there. There's nothing better than four dedicated winter tires on your car. That's where you're going to get the best traction. But that, a lot of people forget that traction is for handling and stopping as well as getting going or getting up a hill. So winter tires, never not a good reason to put winter tires on your car.
Never a bad idea. Joel, thank you so much for your call. An email from Allison. I'm starting the process of finding my next vehicle, and I'm at a loss of what to purchase. I drive more than 800 miles a week for work, so gas mileage is important to me. I work with foster kids around the state and need a roomy back seat, room for bikes, and to be good in the snow. I currently drive a 2012 Chevy Equinox. If you could point me in a good direction, I'd appreciate it. Jamie,
Oh, this is another one where, like, the answer is a Honda CR-V. It's got a good roomy backseat, room for bikes and things. Also, take a look at the Toyota RAV4. Both of them get pretty good gas mileage. A Subaru Outback would be another good option to look at. That one's going to have a little bit less backseat space, but a lot more cargo space overall, and it's a little bit lower to the ground, so it might be easier for kids to get in and out of. But those, I think, are three great options, and they're all three options that have, you know, good reputations for reliability too. So as you're driving 800 miles a week, you know, the car is going to be dependable over the long term. But those are the three that I would really look at to start with.
Okay, we'll go to Tracy calling from Naples. Hi, Tracy, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. I actually have another tire question. I had two new tires put on a couple of weeks ago, and they filled them with nitrogen. What is the difference between that and just the regular air-filled tires? Is it tread wear, mileage, as well as are there any differences in the cold and the heat?
John?
Well, if you can go way back to remembering high school science class, the air we breathe is 78% nitrogen and about 22% oxygen and a couple percentage of some other elements. So when you put regular air in your tires, you're basically putting 78% nitrogen in your tires. Over time, and why people want to put nitrogen in their tires, and this is not a scientific explanation, is the molecules of nitrogen are fatter than molecules of air, so the tires tend to hold the tire pressure a little bit better. Also, nitrogen tends to be a drier air than conventional air that comes out of an air pump. So there's some reasons to put nitrogen in a car. I'm cheap. I would never spend money to put nitrogen in my tires because I know that the air I put in my tires is going to be 78% nitrogen to start off with. The only reason nitrogen would give you better tire wear or better fuel economy is because maybe the tires may stay properly inflated a little bit better, but a little bit of maintenance once a month with a tire gauge and keeping your tire pressure in your car properly inflated is really what you want to do. Is it hurt? Did it do any harm to put nitrogen in your tires? Only if you had to pay extra for it.
Tracy, thanks so much for your call. We do have to go to another break, but a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to be discussing snowmobiling in Maine. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Humanities Council, exploring classic literature with Trollope's The Way We Live Now, March 9th and 10th at Bowdoin, mainehumanities.org. And University of Maine at Presque Isle, offering free and reduced tuition for eligible Maine families, umpi.edu.
President Trump ends his first year in office with record low approval ratings, but rural voters who were crucial to electing him are pretty happy.
I think his tweets are great. That's the only Twitter account I get is Donald Trump. It's a great way to communicate his honest views to the American public.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, The View from Trump Country, 1 year in, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday evening from 4 to 6:30. Here on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for World Affairs. It'll be a discussion on food security in Africa and the work of AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. That's on World Affairs at 2 o'clock in about 20 minutes, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, answers to your car questions. On the line with us, Jamie Page Deaton. She is automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul, a spokesperson for AAA of New England and a master mechanic. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Ron posted this on Facebook. Everybody appears to want all-wheel drive, which is understandable for wintertime driving. However, my wife and I are skiers who need to get to the mountain in the snow, and we have found that a front-wheel drive car with a good set of studless snow tires will outperform an all-wheel drive car on snowy roads. On snowy roads, our 2006 Prius with Bridgestone Blizzaks outperformed our 2012 Outback with the stock low-rolling resistance tires. We put the Blizzaks on the Outback, and of course, it performs better than anything on snowy roads. John, I bet you're not surprised by Ron's Facebook post.
No, not at all. That is fairly typical. The Blizzaks, again, a good quality winter tire. The only negative you can say maybe about a Blizzak is once the soft, sticky rubber compound wears down, they don't do quite as well as they did when they were brand new. But those are people like Ron, that they put winter tires on in the wintertime. They take them off and put another set of tires on. So although there's an investment winter and summer, the idea is you're going to get twice the life out of using the four tires on the car. Yeah, putting good winter tires on a car makes a huge difference in how well it performs.
All right, we're going to go to John calling from China. Hi, John, go ahead.
Hi. My wife has a 2007 Chevy Uplander. She's pretty much the family taxi, picking up the grandkids, taking care of her mother, doing everything. She averages about 40,000 miles a year. The only problem is, you know, of course, I haven't been able to find anything that gets fairly decent gas mileage. This gets about 22 miles to the gallon, and we're looking in a few months to probably get something a little bit newer. But still, I haven't seen anything that gets any better gas mileage. Are they coming out with something or not?
Jamie, a minivan with better gas mileage.
Yeah, I mean, the minivans that you're looking at now are certainly going to do better than 22 miles to the gallon. And even some of the three-row crossover SUVs are going to do better than 22 miles to the gallon. In some cases, you know, if you feather it and if you drive it carefully, and some of the test cars that I've gotten like 27, 28 miles to the gallon. So, you know, going from 2007 to the newer models on the road today, the gas mileage is very much improved. And automakers have done this, you know, in a number of different ways. One is they've started using turbocharged V6 engines instead of V8s or turbocharged four-cylinder engine, so you get, you know, the power of a larger engine, but with the fuel consumption of a smaller engine. They've also done a great job on, you know, saving weight within cars, and then they're also using a lot of cylinder deactivation technology, which is when you use all of the cylinders in an engine to get up to speed, and then once you're at speed and you're cruising and there's less work that needs to be done to keep you there, some of the cylinders shut down, so you're able to just cruise on basically half the engine size, or actually the engine is using half of its power as opposed to all of its power, which saves you a lot of gas. So there are a lot of options out there for you, John. I would take a look at, you know, some of the newer minivans. The Toyota Sienna is a great one. The Honda Odyssey is a great one. If you want to spend a little bit more, there's the Chrysler Pacifica plug-in hybrid, which gets incredible gas mileage and, you know, has an electric-only range, I think, of about, I want to say it's 30 to 50 miles. I can't think of it off the top of my head, though. But, I mean, that's one, too, where if you're really concerned about gas mileage, you can plug it in, you can go, and not be using any gas at all.
All right, John, good luck to you. Let's see. We've got a call from Patrick in Sanford. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, John. Hi, Jamie. How are you?
Great.
So
good.
I kind of have been waiting here. I have one comment and maybe one question. The comment is, can you elaborate your opinion if the reason why we see more trucks being top sellers is we like better sight lines? I think you made a mention earlier, like we are kind of girthy people. Population-wise, we need more space for the value of the vehicle, which is maybe why people like trucks versus other passenger cars. You can comment on that. But the other piece I want to ask each one of you is, you see the evolution of technology in our dash cams, front and back video recording devices evolving in as an accessory, more so, more often in kind of as a option being installed in cars, as you see the Detroit show, the Chicago show, and other shows showing new cars coming out on the market.
John?
Well, I think the idea of having dash cams, front and rear dash cams, I don't know that we're at the point, you know, right now we're seeing there's a couple of, you know, Corvette, for instance, has a front dash cam, but it's more for novelty purposes than security purposes. There may be a time where we see that and we have them in the cars, and it certainly would help ensure, you know, end an insurance dispute about, you know, who went through the red light and who didn't. So maybe we're going to see part of that. There are more issues involved in, you know, where it gets used and does it form another distraction in the car. If it's something that runs all the time and you don't see it, you don't know it's there, similar to a crash recording device, a black box, if you will, that could pull video from maybe 20 or 30 seconds before or after a crash, it could be something that insurance companies maybe kind of coerce the vehicle manufacturers into putting in, you know, more technology, more money. I think, and Jamie and I talked about this at a meeting once, about at what point does the American consumer say, I'm spending too much for technology in my car? I love the idea of it, but at what point do cars get to the point where they're not affordable anymore because they have so much technology in it? And even though you can buy a dash cam for $30, by the time you have it professionally installed in the car and, you know, or built in as original equipment, now maybe that's a couple hundred dollars on an original equipment side added to, you know, satellite radio and all kinds of other, you know, Wi-Fi hotspots and other technology that gets put in cars today. And that's why we're seeing leasing growing the way it is, because cars are getting to the point for a typical family now. They're getting to the point where they're becoming less and less affordable.
We'll go to an email from Greg. Do automakers actually talk to anyone before they decide to introduce a vehicle, or do they simply build what they want and then tell the public this is what they need? That seems to be the case with Ford's new knockoff, the Chevy Colorado, with the new Ranger. They have seemingly done the impossible, creating the non-utility vehicle, the pickup that is incapable of picking up anything outside of a couple bags of dog food. Ford seems to embrace this, as none of their promotional photos show it actually earning a living carrying lumber, bales of hay, or sacks of cement. Would it hurt to poll former Ranger owners to see if this is what they have been waiting for since 2011? Jamie, I know you appreciate a good rant. What's your response to Greg?
I think Greg and I would be really good friends. So, and this actually ties in nicely with Patrick's comment as well. What we're seeing with trucks, they're basically two buyers for trucks. There are the people who use them and who basically sound like Greg, where they're towing, they're hauling, they're using this for work. And yeah, maybe they're using it, you know, to haul some snowmobiles around too. But for the most part, this is a utility vehicle for them. For more and more truck buyers, and I would venture to say the majority of truck buyers now, a truck is a lifestyle vehicle akin to a luxury car, where it projects something about them and it projects their identity. I know that, you know, Ram sales and Silverado sales, the majority of their sales are for their top trims in the, you know, above $60,000. And these trucks are outfitted like luxury cars. In fact, the last Chevy Colorado that I drove as a test car was so luxurious, it cost more than a base Silverado for less capability. But I got a whole lot of technology for it, you know, a lot of interior niceties, you know, touchscreen this that won't work when you're wearing work gloves or any, you know, doing anything that most of us picture truck owners doing. And so what automakers are doing is, yes, they're talking to people. They're just not talking to Greg. They're talking to the more, you know, the segment of the truck market that's going to get them higher profits. And those are the people who are using it as a lifestyle vehicle, or maybe, you know, on the weekends, maybe they're towing a four-wheeler, maybe they have a ski-doo or two, but no, they're not hauling gravel in their truck. No, they're not going to, you know, be doing a whole lot of, you know, DIY projects with it, but they want to look like they could. And they want the truck to drive like a luxury car and feel like a luxury car on the inside. I mean, if you look at some of these, you know, the High Sierra trims, the Denali trims, you know, the Ram Longhorn trim, all of these, you step inside these trucks and you're stepping inside a luxury car. The new Ram that they showed at the Detroit show, it has a 12-inch touchscreen infotainment system. It's like having an iPad, and, you know, honestly, it looks like the interior of a Tesla. And that's because that's where the market's going, because consumers want this stuff. Not all of the consumers who are moving in the truck segment are traditional truck buyers. I mean, to be honest, you know, most of them wouldn't put up with the previous iteration of the Ranger because it just wouldn't be big enough or comfortable enough for them. And so this is where there's more money to be made. You can make a lot more money if you're Ford by stuffing, you know, a Ranger, making it comfortable, selling more of them, even though the truck itself can do less.
We'll go to Cheryl calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a 2013 Dodge Caravan for my four Irish Wolfhounds, but I travel twice a day, 50 miles each time, same place, same exact roads, and I have noticed my gas mileage go from 27 miles per gallon in October down to 22 miles per gallon currently. What's the cause of that?
John, is it the cold weather?
It's the combination of the cold weather and wintertime fuel. The fuel that we use in wintertime is designed to start at lower temperatures. And because of that, it has a little less energy in it. So when we switch over from the fuel that we use in warm weather times to the cold weather times, you can expect sometimes, and I've heard this from fuel manufacturers, a 5 to 7% reduction in fuel economy. Add that into maybe a little bit of cold weather startup, maybe warm up your car a little bit. The engine's just colder, so it tends to use more fuel. If you looked at how the fuel system works, it's just running richer. It's using more fuel when the engine's cold. It's those combinations all together, and maybe you haven't kept up on things like tire pressure quite the way you did maybe in the warmer weather times, because for every 10-pound drop in 10-degree drop in air temperature, you're going to lose a pound or so of tire pressure. You couple all those things together, and that's where your fuel economy goes. And maybe you feed your dogs a little bit more in the wintertime.
Thanks, Cheryl. We're going to try to squeeze in one more call. We're going to go to Shad calling from Lewiston. We're almost out of time, so if you could be quick, that would be great.
Sure. Question for the consumers out there. If you go to the used car lots, you see a lot of pre-owned or used car, lease cars selling and with high resale values, and the new cars have great incentives on financing, and it just seems like there's more cars than buyers right now. So I wasn't sure what the contributors thought in terms of what the future consumers will see in terms of deals, and where would you put your money if you're buying a new car or a used car in the future?
Aha, Jamie.
I would put my money on the best way to be smart about with your money when buying a car is to buy a good, dependable used car, finance it at the lowest rate and the shortest term that you can, and then drive it into the ground so you have a period without payments on it. We are seeing some increased depreciation on used cars. It's like the caller said, it is a lot tougher to get deals on used cars because you don't have the manufacturer putting, you know, cash on the hood like you do with a new car. That said, a good off-lease car that you either, you know, finance at a low rate or you pay cash for is your best option. But expect prices on used cars to go down a little bit. We're seeing a little bit more depreciation, a little bit faster depreciation across the board. So if you're a used car shopper, you know, and you shop smart, you know, shop cars instead of SUVs and trucks. And when you're shopping cars, look for affordable, very fuel efficient small cars for the best deal, because that's where they are depreciating the fastest, because frankly demand just isn't there.
So Jamie, what would be the timeline for Shad? Would you have him wait a couple months before he does this, a half a year?
Well, I mean, when I say they're depreciating slightly faster, we're talking about a percent or two per month.
Okay.
Off the price, which really isn't that much. So, you know, the best time to buy a car is before you need one, so you're not in a rush and can take your time. So, I mean, if you're shopping now, you'll do okay. I mean, you might save, you know, maybe a couple hundred bucks if you wait to the summer. And by a couple hundred, I mean literally like $200. not a huge amount. But if you can wait and look to find a good deal, and you can shop the segments that have lower demand, you can get some good savings there compared to, you know, if you were looking for a brand new, you know, three-row SUV or something like that.
Well, Shad, thanks so much for your call. It is our last one of this hour. And as always, thanks to both of you. Jamie Page Deaton, whose voice you just heard, is automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report. Also with us today, John Paul, spokesperson for AAA of New England and a master mechanic. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. You can find past editions of the show at maincalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, snowmobiling in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.